You're listening to Charlottesville's Podcasting Network. I'm Dan Gould. On February 18th, 2016, Peggy Cornett presented the first lecture in a new four-part CPN Thursday series entitled Jefferson's Legacies. Third President of the United States, Thomas Jefferson, had many interests, including a love of botany. Monticello curator of plants, Peggy Cornett, talks about Jefferson's interest in botany, the effects of which can still be seen today. The lecture series was organized by award-winning historian and Charlottesville-based author, lecturer, and cartographer Rick Britton in conjunction with the Senior Center in Charlottesville. Our podcast is entitled Jefferson's Legacies, Jefferson and Botany. Here's Peggy Cornett.
I'm delighted to be here. Thank you all for coming out. It's a beautiful evening. I hope everyone had dinner. I don't want you to be hungry while I'm speaking. And make sure I'm speaking into the microphone. Everyone can hear me okay? Excellent. Okay, good. You're going to be hearing a lot about different facets of Thomas Jefferson during your series, which looks very interesting. And tonight I'm going to talk to you about his great interest in botany, natural history, nature in general, which he carried throughout his lifetime, beginning as a young man when he lived at Chadwell, his birth site, and study the wildflowers in the woodlands. Jefferson's lifetime, of course, was spent at Monticello and nearby Chadwell across the Ravanna River. And he always longed to return to Monticello during his many absences. Of course, he was away from Monticello serving as Minister to France, Secretary of State, Vice President, President for two terms. He was pretty busy throughout his lifetime, but throughout that period, he continued to reflect on Monticello, to make plans for his gardens, to ask for reports on what his the nature around Monticello was like when he was away, and to plan for his retirement years after his second term as president. And from his garden book, which we study very closely because it is a way for us to understand Jefferson's garden diary throughout his lifetime, he began writing about wildflowers from the time he was still living at Chadwell in 1766. This is the first page from his garden book. And here we see some flowers that were in bloom in his garden, but also some native flowers as well. He talked about the puccoon that opened on April 6th, and then on April 13th, which is now his birthday, the puccoon flowers fall. And this, of course, was the Native American name for the bloodroot. Jefferson was observing this along the Ravanna River, and this flower still blooms quite abundantly there today. This is the foliage, very beautiful. He also mentioned a bluish-colored funnel-formed flower in the low grounds. What do you think he was talking about? Anyone have any ideas? Virginia bluebell, yes. A funnel-formed flower, of course, but he did not mention it by name until years later. But here it is. It's a lovely native flower. Again, blooms quite abundantly at Monticello. Every year I lead a wildflower walk, several of them, in fact, in April. And we walk to the Ravanna River, and there's a glorious sight about mid-April with these beautiful Mertensias in bloom going down to the Ravanna River. Other flowers he talked about in this first page of his book included dwarf flag, or the dwarf crested iris, another native wildflower, which is quite a beautiful garden flower as well, and one that actually is more beautiful in your garden than it is in the wild. And he talked about the wild honeysuckle. And many people wonder, is he talking about Japanese honeysuckle? That's really an invasive plant today, but actually, in his time, wild honeysuckle was referring to the wild azalea, the pinkster azalea, or rhododendron periclymenoides, which there are still a few of these beautiful deciduous azaleas in our woodlands today. Jefferson wrote beautifully about nature. It was often a way in which he reflected on Monticello. One of my favorite lines is, "There's not a sprig of grass that shoots uninteresting to me." And in fact, Jefferson's plans for Monticello included developing the north slope of the mountain into a type of natural area using our native shrubs and vines and trees. He talked about encouraging ivy, and again, this is a name that we think of English ivy today, but ivy in his day was referring to the kalmia, or the mountain laurel. And in fact, the little town of Ivy down the road is named for mountain laurel, not English ivy. A little known fact you may not have known about. And beautyberry, another beautiful native shrub that almost looks like it came from Asia or Japan. It's but it in fact is a native shrub for us, with these gorgeous berries that persist throughout the winter months, and birds will eventually begin to eat them. And he encouraged vines. He wanted vines to grow up onto shrubbery and trees. This was a very popular style in his day of garden landscape, is to allow vines to climb into the shrubbery. And this is the our native honeysuckle, which is actually more beautiful, I think, than the Japanese honeysuckle. But it's not as fragrant. It's not fragrant at all. But this is another flower that he very much wanted to encourage at Monticello. And then he talked about the bubby flower shrub. And we know this today as the sweet shrub. And it's interesting because he actually brought this from the neighboring Green Mountains. And it's the only place, he said, where he's ever seen it in this area of Virginia. But he knew that it was common in South Carolina. And he was talking about the sweet shrub, which is a beautiful, very fragrant shrub that now grows at Monticello. We've planted it near the house, but there are also some clumps of it growing in the woodlands at Monticello. And the former director of Monticello and Gardens and Grounds, Peter Hatch, and I believe that this one clump may have been maybe a remnant from Jefferson's original planting on the mountaintop. And it's called Bubby Bush as well. The flowers were they smell like cherries. They're very, very fragrant. And women used to crush them and put them in their blouses to have a nice fragrance. So that's how it got its name, Bubby Bush. That's the last X-rated comment I'm going to make tonight. So Jefferson also surveyed his mountaintop. He created roads surrounding the mountain, roundabout roads. There are still four roads today that are quite evident. Some of them are in better condition than others. But again, when I do my wildflower walks in the spring, I do travel on many of these paths that lead around the mountain. And these roads were meant to be leveled and to be connected to one another by oblique roads. Of course, Jefferson himself didn't create these roads. They were done by the enslaved labor that were living at Monticello, the African Americans who were enslaved here. But we still have, you can see this arrow pointing to where one of the focal points on this path was a rock that Jefferson detailed on a plat in 1809, and that stone is still sitting there in the landscape. And growing next to it today, you'll see one of his favorite flowering trees, the umbrella magnolia. He just called it the umbrella tree, but it was referring to this native magnolia, which blooms before the leaves come out. It is deciduous. And these have spread down on this northern slope of the mountain where they're quite happy. Jefferson also traveled throughout New England with James Madison, and he collected plants all the way up to the border of Canada. And he also talked about his love of Monticello in letters. This written to James Madison, "The motion of my blood no longer keeps time with the tumult of the world. It leads me to seek happiness in the lap and love of my family, in an interest or affection in every bud that opens, in every breath that blows around me, and an entire freedom of rest, of motion, of thought, owing account to myself of my hours and actions." Jefferson lived in Philadelphia for a number of years as Secretary of State, and he observed and admired trees, large lofty trees around the estates along the Schuylkill River. His home was, or the place where he lived was near the Woodland Estate, which was owned by William Hamilton. And William Hamilton was a bit like Jefferson. He was a plant nut, and he was a collector. And he collected trees and shrubs and plants from all over the world, actually. But he did grow a lot of our native trees on his estate. And Jefferson wrote to William Hamilton when he was planting his grove at Monticello, saying that under the beaming, constant, almost vertical sun of Virginia, shade is our Elysium. And in a sense, Jefferson was trying to imitate the English landscape at Monticello by retaining the shade that the woodlands offered, to limb up the trees as high as their constitutions would allow and keep their canopy united in shade. And then underneath it, to create an English landscape in a sense, but it was a mirrored landscape. It had the shrubberies instead of trees as clumps, and an openness to cut out the superabundant plants, as he wrote. You already had a garden in America if you merely cut out the superabundant plants. This shows his handwriting. And here we have today a restoration or a recreation, I might say, of Jefferson's ideas for the grove, because, again, this was very really written on paper and was never very well diagrammed for us today. So when Peter Hatch first started at Monticello in the 1970s, this was his first project, was to recreate what Jefferson envisioned when he spoke of an American grove. Jefferson carried his devotion to native plants throughout his lifetime, especially while serving as America's minister to France in the mid-1780s. It was at that time that a debate prevailed in Europe over the supposed superiority of Old World plant and animal life compared to their New World counterparts. And this theory was further maintained that European plants immediately degenerated upon contact with the soil and climate of America. And Jefferson, of course, was appalled by this idea. But the greatest proponent for this theory was a man named Buffon, who was the director of the botanical garden, the Royal Botanical Garden in Paris. And he was also the author of a 15-volume scientific tome called Histoire Naturelle. So Jefferson disputed this belief by writing his own natural history. And this was, he called, Notes on the State of Virginia, which was first published in Paris in 1784 and 85. This accidental creation has been called the best single statement of Jefferson's principles, the best reflection of his wide-ranging tasks and talents, and one of the most important literary and philosophical achievements of the 18th century American mind. And here we see Jefferson during that time period, a painting by John Trumbull. And Jefferson, in this book, he arranged for American specimens to be exported to Europe, including some of our grandest native trees and shrubs, to unequivocally prove his point. In a letter from Paris to Angelica Church, he even proclaimed, "Europe is a first idea, a crude production, before the maker knew his trade or had made up his mind as to what he wanted." So it was a real fight going on back then, war of words. And this, from my perspective, the arrangement of the plants, our native flora in this book, is quite intriguing because he divided it into four sections. There were the medicinal plants, because he was always looking for the utility of plants, how they could better Americans, how they could be used in our gardens or in our production of our landscape. And and even medicinal plants were included in this list. The Lobelia syphilitica, for example, the Jimson weed, different mallows, and Indian physic, which is a beautiful native flower. It also is called Galenia, its Latin name, and Bowman's root is another common name for it. But the Indians, Native Americans, called it Ipecacuaha, and that was a source of Ipecac, which you can kind of imagine what that was used for. It seemed like a lot of the medicinal plants were either, you know, meant to either make you throw up or, you know, purge in some way, you know. So that was probably used in that way. He also talked about esculent plants or edible plants in his book, including Jerusalem artichokes, which are native sunflowers, and they produce that little tuber underground that looks like little potatoes. They're quite good. The choke cherry, plums, and crab apples. Persimmon. Persimmon is a very important native fruit, very popular, and not only eaten by people, of course, but also wildlife. It's a very important wildlife food. Here we see a cute little fox squirrel eating it, but also regular foxes ate persimmons, and even wolves were known to have eaten persimmons, and I believe bear probably eat persimmons as well. More esculent plants included our nuts, the pecans, walnuts, bitternuts, chinkapin, hazelnut, and of course the much lost American chestnut, which was a magnificent tree, a tree that is still greatly, we still bemoan the loss of this tree, but one in which we're attempting to bring back. The American Chestnut Society is working to try and return this stately tree to America by crossing it with varieties from China and Europe that are resistant to the chestnut blight that destroyed this tree in America during the early part of the 20th century. And then there was another category called the ornamental trees. And it's an interesting collection of trees here, sycamore, tulip poplar, black poplar, lots of poplars, also buckeyes, the beautiful red buckeye, which you can see here is kind of a small tree. Oh, it almost looks blue there. It should be red. Sorry about that. Catalpa, very ornamental when it's in flower. Of course, it gets a little messy when it drops those seed pods. And other trees include the wild pimento. What do you think that might be? It's actually the spice bush. Beautiful spring flowering shrub in our woodlands very early. And one of its common names is Forsythia of the forest. But it's very lovely. And, of course, our sassafras. Sassafras is not only a beautiful ornamental plant, but it's also used as an edible plant as well. Color is a little bit green here. I'm sorry. Fringe tree is another beautiful native tree that Jefferson promoted. He called it the snowdrop tree. And here it is in Mark Catesby's book. And the black and honey locust. Jefferson used the honey locust actually as a tree to line his upper roadways at Monticello. He thought that the honey locust gave a beautiful shade. And in fact, today, honey locusts are used a great deal as shade trees in parking lots, but they've developed thornless honey locusts. The wild ones have very formidable thorns. They're 3 to 4 inches long, and they also have very broad, kind of messy seed pods. And again, today, the breeders have developed non-fruiting, thornless honey locusts, so it has sort of all the advantages, I guess, although I kind of like those thorns. They're pretty cool. And then useful for fabrication, useful to build our houses with, and to make clothing with, flax, for example. And many of our pines are in this list. And lots of conifers, birches as well, willows, elms, and the red cedar, which I'm going to talk about later. So keep that in the back of your mind. Now, Jefferson's knowledge of botany and natural history was really well known in his lifetime. It wasn't something that we discovered, 200 years later and said, wow, he really knew a lot of Latin names. But people really admired him for this knowledge. And in fact, Benjamin Smith Barton, who was a noted botanist in Jefferson's day, actually named a plant after Jefferson to honor his knowledge of botany and natural history. And he named this plant Jeffersonia diphylla. Beautiful Latin name, Jeffersonia, of course, after Jefferson, and diphylla, referring to the two-parted nature of the leaf. It looks like butterfly wings. And before the American Philosophical Society in 1792, Benjamin Smith Barton proclaimed that it was in honor of Thomas Jefferson Esquire, Secretary of State of the United States, and he went on to state that he had no reference to Jefferson's political character, but rather his knowledge of natural history in the various departments of this science, but especially in botany and zoology. The information of this gentleman is equaled by that of few persons in the United States. And the twin leaf, of course, is a beautiful ephemeral wildflower. It doesn't really grow. It's not native right here in Virginia, but it does grow in western regions of Virginia. And if you travel further west into Ohio, West Virginia and Ohio, it's very common in the woodlands there. And but, of course, we grow it at Monticello. We're obliged to grow this plant. And but as I said, it's ephemeral, so that means it goes dormant. So it's only out for a short time. It blooms for about a week in April, coincidentally around his birthday. And then it's gone, and it really goes dormant by the middle of the summer. So unfortunately, it wasn't this grand shrub or tree. It was a very shy, ephemeral plant, but in some ways it might be more appropriate than anything else. As I said, when Jefferson was in Philadelphia, he really admired trees. He wrote to his daughter, Martha Jefferson Randolph, "I never before knew the full value of trees. My house in Philadelphia is entirely embosomed in high plane trees with good grass below. And under them I breakfast, dine, write, read, and receive my company. What would I not give that the trees planted nearest around the house at Monticello were full grown?" So we know that Jefferson leveled the top of the mountain when he built his home, when he began to build his home. And during his lifetime, obviously the trees were young. They were growing up. We didn't have magnificent trees. And Jefferson was always longing to have these large trees, and he shared our native trees with his friends. One of them was Madame de Tessier in Paris. She happened to be the aunt of Lafayette, a very good friend of Jefferson's. And he admired her for planting trees in her old age. He said, "When I return to Monticello, I think I will become a florist." In other words, I won't have time to see these trees grow to maturity. But she had an enormous estate just outside of Paris called Chaville. And there he sent her great quantities of our native trees, our red buds and dogwoods, even our blush-flowered dogwood, which we know today as our pink dogwood. And people say, "Well, the pink dogwood's a modern invention." But here it is in Mark Catesby's painting of the Mockingbird. You see a pink or flesh-colored dogwood, and it is naturally occurring, but it's just been bred to have a deeper red in cultivation. And he also loved certain large trees around Monticello, including the white oak and the tulip poplar. He said, "Of the oaks I have selected the alba because it is the finest of the whole family. It is the only tree with us which disputes for preeminence with the liriodendron, which is our tulip poplar. It may be called the Jupiter, while the latter is the Juno of our groves." Wonderful quote. We use this all the time to describe these stately trees. And of course, the white oak was a tree that Jefferson loved throughout his lifetime. In fact, his graveyard was situated beneath an enormous white oak where he had wanted to be buried, and where his friend Dabney Carr was buried as a young man. And the tulip tree, really magnificent tree that towers in the woodlands. It is a beautiful tree. It's called tulip tree, of course, because its flowers look a bit like tulips. But they are also, it's hard to see those flowers because they're way up high in those trees. This is an alleged statement of Jefferson's, but it shows to the extent to which he really loved trees. He said, "I wish I was a despot that I might save the noble, the beautiful trees that are daily falling sacrifice to the cupidity of their owners or the necessity of the poor. The unnecessary felling of a tree, perhaps the growth of centuries, seems to me a crime little short of murder." And this was written while he was president and believed to have been said at a Washington dinner party, according to Margaret Bayard Smith. And how many of you have been to Monticello in recent years? Have you been there in the last 5 years? Oh, good. Okay, all right. Well, you've seen some changes at Monticello. I'm sure you have. In the landscape, in the gardens. And we did lose two of our stately tulip poplars just in the last few years. In 2008, the tree here on your right, as you can see, was declining really quickly. The foliage was not leafing out fully, and you could tell that it was very deeply stressed. The one on the opposite side still looked good. But in 2008, the decision was made to take down the tree, and this was actually a photograph of the last day of this tree's life. We all were taking pictures and feeling very sad. All the years I'd been there, this tree was so beautiful and full of shade, but then, as you can see, it was really in bad shape at that point. When it was taken down, which took two nights, the Bartlett Tree Company took it down with a giant crane they brought in very carefully. lowering it down. We found we were hoping to date this tree. We were going to take a slice of the lower level and count all the rings, but it was discovered to be completely hollow all the way to the ground. So there's still a stump left of that tree today. This is showing some of that. So the tree on the opposite side, on the northwest side of the mountain, still stood until 2012. And that was a year when we had a very fierce storm that hit Monticello. It was really like a tornado, a microburst that took down several trees on the other side of the house, on the east front of the house. Peggy Mulberry will remember this very well. And they fell away from the house. One of them, if it had gone the other way, would have crashed right into the front of the house. And one of our sugar maples came down. So anyway, there was a great fear, this being the last tree near the house, that it too might succumb to a fierce storm. So it was taken down that year as well. Now the wood from these trees is used now. It's still being carved into beautiful bowls and other mementos that people can purchase at Monticello. So they're living on in some fashion. But again, we've lost those stately trees that embowered Jefferson's home for so many years. Well, this gentleman is Bernard McMahon, and he was also a person that inspired Jefferson and who played an important role in Jefferson's garden. He wrote a book called The American Gardener's Calendar, and it was really one of the most influential books on gardening in America throughout the 19th century. Jefferson obtained the first edition of this book in 1806 when it was published, and he actually used this as a guide when he was planning his retirement garden at Monticello. And McMahon was also promoting a lot of native plants in his book. He said, many flower gardens are really destitute of bloom during a great part of the season, which could be avoided if the borders of our pleasure gardens, we introduced flowers from our woods and fields. The various beautiful ornaments with which nature has so profusely decorated them in Europe, plants are not rejected because they are indigenous. On the contrary, they are cultivated with due care. Yet here we cultivate many foreign trifles and neglect the profusion of beauty so bountifully bestowed upon us by the hand of nature. They really get into it back in those days. But he was really promoting growing native plants in gardens, and he provided a lot of plants to Jefferson during this period. Here we see Jefferson's plan for his flower gardens. You all recognize this, his winding flower garden walk that ran around the border his leveled west lawn. And here we see the oval beds, again, Jefferson's sketching of what he had in mind that was sent to his granddaughter to be planted with flowers when he finally retired. He wanted everything put into place. And one of the flowers that we believe actually McMahon sent to him was the cardinal's flower, the beautiful Lobelia cardinalis. McMahon included seeds of this in a shipment, and Jefferson sowed it in an oval bed on the northwest side of the mountain of Monticello. And it still grows there. I mean, we still grow it there today. It's a short-lived perennial. But it has one of the deepest scarlet flowers that was known at that time. And in Europe, people really admired the quality of red. And, of course, you don't see it very well in this picture, but it is red on my screen right in front of me here that this flower had. And that's where it got its name, of course, cardinal flower for the Roman Catholic cardinal bishops. Of course, he would have planted his namesake in this garden, the Jeffersonia. Here we see that written here as a blow-up on one of the oval beds. It kind of looks like he wrote an exclamation point next to that Jeffersonia, but I think it's just a line indicating the border of the house. But in any case, he wanted an entire bed of Jeffersonia. And Jefferson really longed to retire to Monticello, especially during those last 3 years of his presidency. It was all that he could think about was to have his gardens laid out and to spend time with his family and to pursue botany and to study nature. And as you can see in these two quotes, Jefferson really longed for this tranquil pursuit of science. Botany I rank with the most valuable of sciences. No country gentleman should be without what amuses every step he takes into his fields. Kind of sounds a little bit like Walden But one plant really befuddled him, and one that he really could never quite bring into his garden, but one he wanted. And it was this curious plant that's native to North. Do you all know this plant, the Venus's flytrap? It's native to North Carolina, a very narrow section of the coastal region, and it's a very rare and endangered native plant. But when it was first discovered, everyone had to have it. You know, Benjamin Franklin, they wanted to send it to England, to Europe. And Jefferson tried sending seed to Madame de Tessé, and it never seemed to succeed, as far as we know. There's never really a report of that. But he finally wrote that botany is a school of patience, and its amateurs learn resignation from daily disappointments. So, again, that was probably one of his failures. So Jefferson was always looking westward for Monticello. Really, Monticello was at the edge of the frontier in his day. People were moving westward all the time, and his idea, of course, which he kept for many years, was to explore the West all the way to the Pacific. But he didn't publicly voice this plan until 1801 in his presidential inaugural address, when he dared to envision a rising nation spread over a wide and fruitful land, advancing rapidly to destinies beyond the reach of mortal eye. And of course, this was his concept, his vision for the what would become the Lewis and Clark expedition. He, 2 years later, he sent a confidential message to Congress requesting appropriation of $2,500 for an exploration of the West to the Western Ocean. With this quiet, clandestine arrangement, Jefferson commissioned Meriwether Lewis and William Clark to lead a corps of discovery on what would become a 3-year journey across America's vast, unexplored regions. For its day, this ambitious undertaking is likened to our present attempts to travel to the moon or even Mars. And it is believed that if Jefferson had not been elected president, third president of the United States, he would have led the expedition himself. On the eve of the venture, before the explorers set off from St. Louis in 1804, Jefferson predicted, "We shall delineate with correctness the great arteries of this great country, and those who come after us will fill up the canvas we begin." And I have a whole talk on the Lewis and Clark plants, and so I'm not going to get into all that, but maybe you can invite me back sometime and I'll do that talk. I did it for the staff at Monticello just this last year. But I want to end on the subject of birds. Jefferson really loved birds, and by the 1790s, he had accumulated a considerable knowledge of American birds, both from observations and from study of books in his own library, especially Mark Catesby's Natural History of the Carolinas and the 10 volumes of Oiseaux in the Comte de Buffon's Histoire Naturelle. He included a list of 125 Virginia birds in his notes on the state of Virginia, and he added 32 to Catesby's total and providing the Linnaean binomials where possible. Yet he cannot be described as an ornithologist. In the days before binoculars, when the only way to study wild birds was to shoot them, Jefferson soon retired from the field. He abandoned hunting in 1784 and began to watch birds as one of what he called the indexes of climate, believing that an estimate of climate may be otherwise made from the advance of the spring as manifested by animals and vegetable subjects. And although the term was unknown to him, he became a phenologist, which is someone who studies the relationship between climate and periodic biological phenomenon. In 1784 to 1817, in his weather memorandum book, Jefferson charted the advance of spring by noting the flowering and leafing of trees and shrubs and the arrival of birds and insects. The purple martin was the bird he observed with the greatest regularity. It first appeared at Monticello each spring as early as March 18th and as late as April 9th. The Marquis de Chasteloup, Jefferson owned the Alexander Wilson's book, the Marquis de Chasteloup, who visited Jefferson in 1782, noted that Americans have an almost superstitious respect for these birds, and he decried the varied martin houses used to attract them. The more credulous citizens, he said, considered Martins as luck bringers, while the sensible majority of the population welcomed them as destroyers of insects and bold assailants of marauding birds of prey. The Marquis devoted an entire appendix of his book to the purple martin and the perplexing question of where it spent the winter. While there were still proponents of the ancient belief that birds took up their winter quarters on the moon, a newer theory of torpidity or hibernation had a host of disciples. They proclaimed that during the cold season, some martins and swallows took refuge in hollow trees, while others slept in the muddy bottoms of lakes and rivers. It's amazing, isn't it? During Chasteloup's 1782 visit, he and Jefferson certainly debated these issues. And the Marquis believed that martins and swallows must go to countries where winged insects still fill the air during the winter. He was on the right path, because that's what birds do. They migrate to southern regions. But Jefferson's own opinion on the subject remains unclear. But the terminology in his weather book gives us some clues, according to Cinder Stanton. Rarely do birds arrive in spring. In almost every case, Jefferson writes that they appear or disappear, or he noted that they are here or they are out. In 1796, he wrote in a letter, "Spring is now opening on us, the birds issuing from their state of torpor. Narcissus are putting up, etc." And later observations would confirm his belief that birds and insects hibernated. So, you know, Jefferson wasn't always right, but he did admire birds, and he noted many birds. And I'm just going to show some images of beautiful images of birds from Alexander Wilson's book on ornithology, and some of the birds mentioned some of the birds that Jefferson listed, including blackbirds and bluebirds and finch, of course, cardinals. He described flickers as yuckers, and kingbirds were tyrant birds. A wagtail was probably a phoebe. A redbreast was probably a robin, and swallows, river swallows, and the incognito bird, which was probably the wood thrush, and wrens. And he also recorded the visit of flocks of snowbirds, which were juncos, and lettuce birds, which were goldfinch. Second to the martin in number of weather memorandum references was the whippoorwill. Oh, here we see some of the other birds. Purple martin there at the top left, swallows, whippoorwills. Which was heard at Monticello from April 2nd to the 21st. And in my 32 years working at Monticello, years I was at Tufton Farm, I never heard a whippoorwill sing. So he heard them quite often. Renowned ornithologist and bird portraitist Alexander Wilson, who visited Jefferson in 1805, when he was in the early stages of writing this American Ornithology, presented Jefferson with a painting of what he called capital songsters, the wood thrush, the robin, the catbird, and the mockingbird. And I'll get down to them. Here we are. Wood thrush, robin. Here we have nuthatch and mockingbird. Here's the brown thrasher on the top left. And here's the mockingbird. The mockingbird's a special bird. I'm going to end on the mockingbird. In 1792, when he had a young wife, a month-old child, and an unfinished house, Thomas Jefferson acquired a family pet. For 5 shillings, he bought a mockingbird from one of the slaves of his father-in-law, John Wales. It was the first in a procession of singing birds that would always be a part of Jefferson's household. He continued purchasing them from Tidewater, Virginia, for at that time the wild mockingbird was not a resident bird in central Virginia. But by the 1790s, while living in Philadelphia, Jefferson noted their arrival in a letter he wrote to his son-in-law, Thomas Mann Randolph. "I sincerely congratulate you on the arrival of the mockingbird. Learn all the children to venerate it as a superior being in the form of a bird, or as a being which will haunt them if any harm is done to itself or its eggs. I shall hope that the multiplication of the cedar in the neighborhood and all the trees and shrubs round the house will attract more of them, for they like to be in the neighborhood of our habitations if they furnish cover." And I'll repeat that statement again. They like to be in the neighborhood of our habitations if they furnish cover. Well, today we talk about creating habitat for wildlife. This is a real buzzword today. Everyone's talking about this as a way to plant your gardens, to maintain your landscapes, to control your fields so that birds can still exist there. And here Jefferson puts it in a very different way, but in a very clear way, a very clear observation. And in fact, the red cedar was not indigenous to Central Virginia in Jefferson's day. It was being brought in. His son-in-law planted a lot of it. And now, of course, it's ubiquitous. It spread very easily by birds, of course. Birds eat the berries, the blue berries on the cedar. And they sit on a fence, and they plant those berries out of the back of the bird, as they say. So that's how they're spread quite readily in our landscape. And of course, they're male and female trees. I won't get into all that. But, you know, red cedars are now kind of maligned today because they are the alternate host for the cedar apple rust. And if you're an orchardist, like we are at Monticello, we grow apples, this tree is a host of a disease that spends its winter on the cedar. It's a big, kind of a gruesome-looking, brainy-looking structure on the tree, and then that thing will explode and send its spores out to the apple tree, where it causes a rust on the fruit and the leaves. So a lot of orchardists want to get rid of that tree, but I'm showing you the mockingbird again. I'm showing it the dogwood earlier, but it was a very popular bird. Now, when Jefferson was president, in the president's house, he actually kept cages of birds, pet birds. And one of his birds he named Dick. This was his favorite bird, unquestionably his favorite bird. And Margaret Bayard Smith, his friend, he also kept him at Monticello in this greenhouse. He actually had an aviary for this bird. But when he was still president, Margaret Bayard Smith described his cages of mockingbirds that were kept in among his roses and geraniums in the window recesses of his cabinet. And she wrote that Jefferson cherished his favorite bird with peculiar fondness, not only for its melodious powers, but for its uncommon intelligence and affectionate disposition, of which qualities he gave surprising instances. It was the constant companion of his solitary and studious hours. Whenever he was alone, he opened the cage and let the bird fly around the room. After flitting for a while from one object to another, it would alight on his table and regale him with its sweetest notes, or perch on his shoulder and take its food from his lips. Often when he retired to his chamber, it would hop up the stairs after him, and while he took his siesta, would sit on his couch and pour forth its melodious strains. Now, the mockingbird has beautiful songs. They imitate other birds, but mockingbirds were actually trained. Slaves would actually capture these birds when young. They were trained to sing melodies. They would teach them to sing Scottish melodies. So they weren't just singing other bird songs. They were singing real songs. And this was what Dick did, I presume, at Monticello. So it's very curious that someone would raise a bird and grow up and keep a bird as a pet. And, you know, we don't really do that sort of thing today. Oh, maybe we do. Way back many years ago, this terrible yellow, it's not a mockingbird though, was brought a baby bird that had fallen out of a nest, and I raised it to adulthood in the greenhouse at Monticello. This was back when I was the assistant director of gardens and grounds, and I took care of the plants in that greenhouse. And so I named this little brown thrasher Scrapper. And he followed me all around the greenhouse, and he ate bugs, so I'd move the pots around, and he would gobble them up. And then eventually he went back to the wild. It was really a wonderful maternal moment for me because, you know, I never really had kids, but this was, I saw him go out into adulthood and become wild again, and it was a wonderful experience. So I sort of had that at Monticello, which I'll never forget. But okay, so I'll end now with some words of Jefferson again to inspire you about nature and to inspire you to come back to Monticello often to see it. And this was from a letter he wrote to a very close friend of his when he was living in Paris, Madame Maria Causeway. And Jefferson really wanted her to come and visit him at Monticello when he retired. So he wrote this beautiful letter. He wrote, "Our own dear Monticello, where has nature spread so rich a mantle under the eye? Mountains, forests, rocks, rivers, with what majesty do we there ride above the storms? How sublime to look down into the workhouse of nature, to see her clouds, hail, snow, rain, thunder, all fabricated at our feet. And the glorious sun, when rising as if out of a distant water, just gilding the tops of the mountains and giving life to all nature." Thank you very much for your attention.
For the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, I'm Dan Gould.